And this is
Hey.
25, 50.
There we are. Yep.
Ooh.
Income averages. Let's open a hearing then on House Bill 2554. And Ed, if you could give us a brief background, and we'll take Representative Butler's testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2554 would permit personal income taxpayers to use the federal farm income averaging method in order to compute their Oregon personal income taxes on farm income. This provision would apply tax years beginning January 1, 2002 and thereafter.
Representative Butler, welcome.
Thank
Glad
you.
Glad to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I bring you this bill today, actually a compilation of a couple of bills. Primarily today, starting off with House Bill 2554, permitting an income taxpayer on their personal income tax return to have income averaged in the farm method, similar to what's available on the federal income tax method. Today, we don't see a great deal of farm income in the state of Oregon for a number of reasons known to many of us, but certainly the dry years in which we're facing right now don't look like they would be that much better. And the income averaging concept is a tried and proven test within the federal income tax community to allow income taxpayers and the income receiving income from farm operations to average over the prior 3 years incomes when they would have an opportunity to have higher farm income in 1 year over another. And what it does is it takes some of the down years and gives you an opportunity, should you have an upside year, that calculation then would reduce the income taxes themselves. Now, in the federal, on a federal income tax return, the actual effect of income averaging is much more pronounced, because you could go from a zero bracket, potentially clear up 36 or 39.6%, whereas in Oregon, our brackets are not that steep and start out at 0 or 4% and then move rapidly to 9%. So there's not a great deal of fiscal impact, but it would take out some of the sting. Potentially a farmer who had zero farm income for the immediate prior 3 years and then was able to income average as a result of having $40,000 in the fourth year would basically then be paying, using those brackets between 0 and 9% in that fourth year on that farm income. It would just be a graduated amount and not a great deal of fiscal impact, but I would like to have the opportunity of introducing the concept back into the farming community. The farmers, in as much as they can't control their farm income, certainly could have the benefits of the fact that they've had some years with zero when they do have a year that is productive.
Thank you. Questions? Have we ever had income averaging for four farmers? John Schoenberg is telling me yes.
Okay. In the state of Oregon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. State of Oregon, previously, when we were a start from scratch income tax state, we did have income averaging. Income averaging was a viable concept and was utilized. It was right along with the federal income tax returns side by side. And again, we need to introduce the concept again over those of us who might be able to control our capital gains, our source of our ordinary income, and other kinds of things, where farmers can't dictate the amount that they would get in any 1 year out of any particular crop. They're pretty much at the whim and wish of the overall economy that will pay them for the crop that they're selling in that particular year.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Butler?
Sure.
Yes, Representative Hess.
Are there other places where income averaging on taxes would be applicable? Like, I think of some capital gains areas where it would be nice to spread those out or average those out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hess, this bill does not provide for that. However, there is a bill to come up relative to the capital gains portion. But right now, if you have a capital loss, and the loss is over $3,000, that line of loss would be carried over into the ensuing years until such time as there was a capital gain to use it up. Otherwise, under Oregon's current law, we're limited to a maximum of a $3,000 deduction of that loss. And in that regard, what happens is that you have to take some of the sting out of a capital loss. Out of a capital gains, right now under current law, it's just taxed in that year, and this bill does not change that relative to any other types of income other than farm income on a farm Schedule F or reported from a farm Schedule F coming through from a other type of entity. If you're in a farm partnership, your share of farm partnership farming income would be subject to income averaging. And again, if you're in a farm partnership that was consistently showing under the current laws over $10,000 a year net profit, then there would be no benefit. If you were $10,000 a year for all of the base years, and then you had $100,000, there's no benefit in the income averaging right now in a farm income averaging situation. Even under this law, there wouldn't be a benefit. But this is not inclusive of any other kinds of income, such as wage income or annuity income or other types of voluntary income that you could accelerate. This is exclusively limited to farm schedule type income, farming income, farming and ranching.
Representative, I think you were next.
There's a couple questions real quick. I already thought there was a five-year income tax averaging. I think this allows a shorter period of time, and that's probably something of significance for farmers, you know, considering the volatility of commodity prices and the fact that individual farmers are completely at the risk of this thing. As a part-time farmer, I understand what you're getting to here, okay? So you have some support. Does this also bring the Oregon tax law into alignment with the federal tax law? And this is something allowed under federal taxes that is not allowed under Oregon taxes right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, this law would be in absolute conformity with what the federal law is, and you're absolutely right. We used to have a five-year income averaging for farm and other types of income under federal law and under state law, mm-hmm. And then when income averaging was done away with, when we went to a, if you will, a flat tax at the federal level, there was no reason to try and anticipate that. This merely introduces the three-year, which is the same as what federal has reintroduced. It introduces that same concept back into the state of Oregon that federal has reintroduced, not from a five-year, but to match the federal law of 3 years.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Butler just answered my question.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
I think he partially answered my question, Mr. Chair, but I'm just curious. Why was it, okay, we had this before, and then it was stopped, and now it's being reintroduced again. What was the reason for doing away with it? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that's a very valid question. Under federal law, a number of years ago, what happened was that the income tax rates were, which were very, very very, very accelerated to a high percentage very quickly, that steep incline of rates that a person was subject to when they filed their income tax return, if you could income average, and that is to throw in various years of lower income against the high income year, then there was a rather significant savings, because what you were doing in the high income year was that out of that income year, you would basically say, well, over the past 5 years, the income has been much less. And so you would take, let's call it one-fifth of the historical would be averaged against the current year. And so what would happen is that it would move it back down that rather steep incline of graduated marginal rates. Then when the federal law was introduced, the concept of a more of a flat rate taxation, the indication was at that time, well, we don't need any kind of, we don't have this fast accelerating, we're gonna make it into a more of a flat tax. And so as long as people were paying in a 15 to 28% tax bracket to back up ways, then you didn't have the benefit of income averaging, and income averaging was not as much benefit under a flat tax program. And so income averaging was done away with under the federal law, and the five-year concept was done away with. A few years ago, with the graduation, the tax rates have now been tinkered with since the original days of the concept of a flat tax. And I can show you, like I did with clients up on the board, how that flat tax was concocted to be an absolute flat tax, because what had happened is that you could go along on the chart and then you could see it jump up 3%. And that 3% was a clawback, and it would come back and fill in areas that had been taxed at 15% so that there would be a 20%+ tax rate even throughout all of the income of a person that was earning in excess of $250,000. And so the concept of averaging, basically you couldn't be averaging something in the 20% bracket over these many years and something in the 20% bracket now. There was no benefit in income averaging. So the concept went away. We've now moved back up again to a rather steep incline to a 39.6% tax bracket under the federal guidelines, federal law and statute. And in so doing, then a few years ago, the concept of income averaging in the farm community for federal income tax purposes was reintroduced. Oregon, which is connected to the federal, did not reintroduce the income averaging at that point. And that's what 2554 does, is it reintroduces it back in. And again, the savings, however small, the concept is there and should be dignified in state law as it is in federal.
Just a comment, Representative Housley. I have this vague recollection in the mid or late 70s, when this being Higher Education Day as it is, when my husband was in law school and then he became employed, and we had this gap between mm-hmm. income
right.
that we did. I think I recall doing income averaging in 70s.
Yeah,
right. 70s.
Mm-hmm.
7, 7,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's absolutely right. It was not conceived that it would be only a farm issue at that point. It was all income, and you were, as long as you had filed a joint return during that period of time, those prior 4 years, and as long as you had met all the rest of the qualifications during the base year period, then you could go ahead and file an income average for the year that the husband got out of school and became actively employed and got the big wage jobs, and a number of us used to take advantage of that and rub our hands and say, boy, won't we be something when we're able to make it on our own and actually making $8,000 or $10,000 a year, because you'd average that back against in times when things were pretty skinny.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that's where we're at in the farm community.
Unfortunately, Representative Bates.
You may not know the answer to this question, I don't know myself. Did the federal law change just for farming, or is it a wider law that allows everyone to do income averaging now for 3 years? Because that might have more of a physical impact on the state than just this, what you're introducing right now, if that were this were the beginning of a rollout for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, currently the federal law provides for income averaging for the prior 3 years on farming.
Only.
Only.
Okay.
Anything else?
Chairman,
yes.
Phrases like clawback and base year, I think maybe Representative Butler's on the wrong side of the fence.
How about that?
He speaks our language.
Better than we do. I agree. Thank you for an excellent exposition, presentation on that. Now, my question to you is, if Don Schellenberg signed up to testify on this bill as well, but you're also on 2555. Do you want me to proceed to 2555 and let you get out of here?
Sure, that would be absolutely wonderful.
Then in that case, I will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2554 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2555. Ed.
House Bill 2555 is another bill designed to give relief to farming activities. It reduces the personal and corporate income tax rates to 5% on net long-term capital gains derived from liquidation of assets used in farming. The bill defines what the qualified farming activities are and stipulates that the reduced tax rate is available provided the sale, quote, constitutes a substantially complete termination, unquote, of taxpayers' farming business activity. The changes apply to tax years beginning January 1, 2002 and thereafter.
All right. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, this bill, addresses an issue which of tax fairness, basic tax fairness, within the farm community by introducing a reduction in long-term capital gains derived from the disposition of assets used in a farming or ranching business. In this regard, right now, our federal capital gains rates max at 20%. The state tax rate on capital gains continues at 9%. And so, being roughly less than the capital gains, roughly a little more than half of that 20%, a little more than half of the 39.6, I have introduced House Bill 2555 to indicate that capital gains, long-term capital gains rates for the disposition of farm and ranch assets, particularly as assets are used in a disposition of a farming or ranching operation, would basically be treated very similar to what they're treated under federal law with a preferential tax rate. And in this regard, my comments would be that, again, it introduces the tax fairness issue into the disposition of farm and ranch operations. This does not mean that people will leave the farm and forever not return to the farm, but certainly they could dispose of a farming operation, get out of the farming business, and then if they wanted to return to the farming business at a later time or return to a farming entity after a disposition where this isn't a trade of a farm, this is an actual sale and a disposition in that fashion where it's a taxable activity, as they wind down and terminate the farm or ranch activity, this brings some tax fairness into those folks. And many times, in my professional experience as a certified public accountant, usually where I see this issue is where I have one of two things happening. I've either had a death in the family, and a rather severe situation which will culminate in death, or just the actual wind down of the operation when the people just say, we can't continue to feed the farm and feed ourselves, and when they will actually start the dispositions and termination of their farming and ranching activities. And so, again, what happens in this regard is that to the extent that we pay the state of Oregon, based upon ordinary income tax rates, a full 9%, there is some inequitable activity that happens here, and the state takes more than its proportionate share. Frequently, I'm left with folks that do not have sufficient to pay their final wind-down bills, and including the mortgage on the place as they begin to wrap up. And so what this does in part is it may actually assist other people to receive income out of the disposition of a farm and ranch sale, out of those proceeds, as they're able to pay off the seed bill and pay off the fertilizer bill and those other kinds of things by not sending that money to the state of Oregon. So, again, it introduces a basic concept of fairness in the disposition of the farm and ranch operation and wind down.
Questions? Representative Brown.
Tom, do you know, does this also apply to other types of small businesses? Does, you know, the you spoke about the inequity in the
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, this bill, House Bill 2555, only applies to farming operations at this particular point. Farming and ranching operations is the limit of the scope and nature of House Bill 2555. Again, it's to bring some equity back within the farm community, a community which has proven to be very vital to the state of Oregon and our business enterprises and interests, but has suffered rather substantially in the world economy and our national and local economies, our inability to be able to produce and compete based upon the many, many factors and the weights that are placed upon our farm and ranch community, not just within Oregon, but certainly nationwide, as we look at the inability to use certain pesticides and chemicals and those sorts of things. So this bill introduces the concept only relative to the farming and ranching as we're winding down those assets. If you were a farmer and rancher and there was a wind down of a number of activities. This would apply to just those farming and ranching activities, those assets that are sold, and it would not apply to the machinery and equipment as a normal basis, because that is not normally a capital asset as defined under Oregon and federal code, the federal code to which Oregon is connected with. I don't know whether I got that answered or not, Mr. Chair.
If somehow we were able to buy a capital gains rate reduction across the board to 5%, well, this would take care of that problem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. If you were to pass a capital gains rate across the board for all taxpayers within the state of Oregon at a 5% rate, then this would absolutely not be necessary for the farm and ranch community. My beg and petition of this committee today is that you consider it as an equitable issue relative to our farm and ranch community, as a result of the fact that this is a dying industry, an industry which is so very vital to our food and fiber production, not just within the Northwest, but throughout the United States.
Okay. Representative Bates.
Just so I can defend this from my caucus, I'm going to ask a couple of questions, okay? I'm trying to, in my own mind, think of an example where this would actually take place. You know, it's not a machinery, so I'm thinking maybe it's depreciation on buildings, that depreciation got ahead of the value, and when they get to sell it off, they got a certain amount for the value, but the depreciation forced them to pay capital gains on the difference or something. How would this actually come about as an example of someone selling the farm, they're not going to farm that particular piece anymore, liquidating, you know, a capital gain when the place has been losing money. And that's why they quit. They don't, you know, it's the old story, you keep farming until the money runs out, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, yes, that's what happened to the farmer who won the lottery. They didn't ask him what he would do with it, and he just said, I'll just farm until it's all gone.
Right.
that's the concept here. Anticipation.
You guys ever heard that before?
No.
Amongst us farmers, that's a common story. Go ahead.
And Representative Bates says that the concept here is that it's anticipated that over a period of time, just through raw inflation, and certainly the farmer isn't the cause of the inflation, but he's certainly paying the 9% effects on the inflation, the raw inflation on just the land would be what would be involved in large part here. So I anticipate that now there are sections of our code which tie to the federal code, which where there is depreciation, and that where that depreciation has occurred, depreciation is recaptured at ordinary rates, and that those ordinary rate recaptures of depreciation not affected here. It's only on capital assets and as defined under the state and federal code. Those are very easily identified. There's not a lot of mechanics that moves into this relative to the tax code. It's merely the identifying of the farm assets upon which there is a true capital gain, long-term capital gain, and then that capital gain would be subject to the 5% maximum tax. Basically, you'd calculate your tax in two different portions, similar to what you do today on a page 2 of a Schedule D. D is in long-term capital gains.
Thanks.
Okay. Great. Appreciate the conversation and bringing these forward to us. We will, I guess, take Don Schoenberg's testimony, which I assume is going to be in support of both of these.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
You
the most time.
For bringing them to us, Representative Butler.
Thank you.
Don, welcome. While we're in hearing on 2555, do you want to start with that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Don Schoenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Pleased to be here to support my good friend, Representative Butler, and the bills that he's put forth, very important bills. I've been in the farming business all my life. In the 60s and 70s, I did my own taxes, farming. Went through all the forms and all that kind of thing, so I know the headaches that you run through in doing those, and I remember we did have income averaging, and we used that during that time. I also know that the legislature here each year reconnects, or has a reconnect bill that comes through this committee that reconnects to the federal law. We don't always reconnect everything, but Farm Bureau policy supports reconnection to maintain the way we treat the same income at the federal and the state level, so it's so it's easily conformed, and you can only need to keep one set of books. I remember when there was a different depreciation schedule at the federal level than there was at the state level for a couple of years, and what a mess that was. And so on the issue of the capital gains here, that's a little bit different issue. I guess I was kind of mixing 54 and 55 here together. but on this particular issue, Mr. Chairman, you hit the nail on the head.
Let me just go ahead and open simultaneously the hearing on 2554, so you can talk about either one of them or both of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only concern I had, as you raised the concern regarding 2555, was whether it would in any way take away from the move to enact an overall 5% capital gains tax, which we certainly would support. But in lieu of that, we certainly would support this concept here, and certainly House Bill 2554 we support as well. I'll just leave it at that.
Questions for Mr. Schoenberger? All right.
Thank you.
Why don't you go ahead and stay there, because you're up on the next bill, right?
Well, let me give you this, and then get my testimony.
Okay.
And
I will. All right. Well, while you're doing that, I will close. Unless there's anybody else who wishes to testify on either 2554 or 2555, if not, I'll close the hearings on both of those bills and open a public hearing on House Bill 2876 and invite Lizbeth to come up and give us the what's more.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, what you have in this third bill is House Bill 2876. It is a property tax measure which is allowing consolidation of smaller parcels of agricultural land into larger parcels, and it's establishing the following requirements for that consolidation of the parcels of real property. And the parcels have to be EFU zone parcels. They have to be contiguous and commonly owned, and at least one of the parcels is smaller than the minimum lot size for the EFU zone. The consolidated parcels receive a property tax exemption then for 10 years beginning in tax year 2002-03. So under current law, what we have is counties can adopt their guidelines for the minimum lot sizes or parcel sizes are for EFU land that is not range land. The minimum parcel size is 80 acres. For range land, the minimum lot size is 160 acres. And a county can elect to adopt a lower minimum parcel size if they can demonstrate to the Land Conservation and Development Commission that the lower parcel size requirements are appropriate for maintaining existing commercial agricultural enterprises within their area. So what we see is that Oregon counties have a variety of minimum lot size requirements depending on the type of agricultural and other characteristics of the area. So currently, there are numerous parcels of land statewide which do not meet this minimum lot size requirement, and there is no property tax incentive in place right now to encourage consolidation of parcels of land. Under current law, with EFU land, which is used for farm use, it does qualify for a special assessment. The EFU land is then valued at the farm use by utilizing the income approach to arrive at a value per acre for EFU farmland. Roughly, we have about 12.8 million acres of EFU zone land in the state. And also, on EFU land, you can get your home site to be specially assessed under 308A256. So as far as a revenue impact, it's still in progress. The revenue impact is hard to arrive at because we don't know exactly how many small parcels of land would actually be consolidated with larger parcels of land, in which then the whole property tax exemption for 10 years would be given for that particular parcel. It's also not real clear from the bill exactly if the property tax exemption is just applying to land or if it's also applying to other real property on that consolidated partial, buildings, homes, other structures.
Thank you, Don and Jack Chapin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau, and with me is Jack Chapin. Just a word about Jack. Many of you probably don't know Jack. Some of you might. Jack has been very involved in the Farm Bureau for years, and for, I don't know for how many years, he can probably tell you, he was chair of our Tax Advisory Committee at the Farm Bureau. And he has written, literally written, much of the farm use assessment tax law that we have in the statutes today, over the course of his history of involvement. And some years ago already, this issue of consolidation came to the forefront as parcels of land were continuing to be divided into ever smaller and smaller pieces. And Jack, can I'll have Jack tell you what the problem with that is. But we, as a committee, talked about what can we do to reverse that trend. And so they came upon the idea of when there are two parcels in the same ownership that are contiguous, and one or more, one or both, or it could be two or three or four, as far as that goes, but one or more are smaller than the minimum, the applicable minimum lot size, that you provide a 10-year property tax exemption for the smallest of the parcels. It's not a lot. The question might be, you know, what's the fiscal impact? No one would know because we don't know how many people would take advantage of it. In my testimony, what you can read, I talked about if you just took an example of land with an assessed value, farm use assessed value at $1,000 an acre, and a maximum property tax rate of $15 per thousand, that would amount to, over a 10-year period, $150. Per acre. Yeah, the $150 over a 10-year period, per acre. The rule of thumb always is that you can, if you divide a parcel in two, you can always sell the sum of the two for more than you can sell the whole. That's the way it always goes. And the $150 that you would receive for combining those into one parcel, that would actually be less than the two parcels individually, worth less on the market than the two parcels individually, is really does not recover any kind of cost that you would stand by doing that. But it is an incentive, and it was the committee's desire to provide some kind of incentive to get parcels back into a way where they're being consolidated back into parcels that are sizable and affordable for farmers and ranchers. So that's what this bill is about. I'll just let Jack talk about the bill a little bit more and why this is important to agriculture.
We'll refrain from questions until after we hear from Mr. Chapin, and then we'll ask both.
Well, thank you, members of the committee. I'm happy to be here. I'm glad you don't have tenure here for lobbyists, because I'd be out about five times already.
Yeah.
Don said I was chairman of the taxman. I believe it was 27 years, something like that. Anyway, Don has pretty well described the whole thing here, what we have, and it's very well described by the lady here, so you know what we're talking about. I don't think the fiscal impact would be very large. I wish it would be. Mm-hmm. I think this is just a small step in the right direction. Everything, all the pressures are to divide the farmland up into smaller and smaller parcels. There's always, as Don said, always more money to be had from a small parcel per acre than in a large parcel. Fact of the matter is, Kim Worrell and I worked out a chart. He did the working out and I was involved, let's put it that way. He was an assessor from Yamhill County, and we showed that at one time here, what it was. And it's, as the lot gets bigger and bigger, it gets smaller and smaller, it goes the other way around. And we devised other laws based on that principle, which are still working. But now, I don't know whether
Now, I always like to say I'm a farmer, and I'm involved in most of these things, and I like to make sure that I'm not talking about something that is going to impact me financially. As I'm here, I'm talking, you know, to get the point across because I want to do such and such. I don't think this in any way involves me now. There was a time, however, when a piece of property came up for sale next to me. It was just 1 acre. It was an eyesore. It was a place that had been cut off many, many years ago, a rundown house, and the class of people you don't want to live next to, dope and you name it. And it was kind of like I had a gun in my rib, so, gee, I had to buy it. Got a chance to buy it, and so what did I do? I had to pay five times what it was worth, and somehow or another I worked it so that my daughter had the money and she bought it because I didn't want it to be tacked onto my farm that way. Now then, I don't care, but at that time. So people always maneuvered to keep from combining lots. I'm just using it, and me included, but this would give some incentive to turn it the other direction. Not a big incentive, but some incentive. And I don't believe that it would be enough fiscal impact here to cause any particular problem. If it did, it would be doing a lot of good. That's the way. I don't know just what questions I can field here.
Let's see. Are there questions of the committee? Comments?
So, I appreciate getting to talk here again.
It's my Representative Beck.
So we're trying to promote the creation of larger parcels in EFU zones, right?
Yes. Yeah. And excuse me, may I add further?
Yes.
Go ahead. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt. Shoot, one more thing here. I'm very hard of seeing. The last few years I've got macular degeneration, so you folks just blur. I'm sorry to mention that, but if I do something strange, I hope you'll realize that. I forget now just exactly what I was going to say on that.
Large blocks, he was asking about.
The objective being.
And it's also these small blocks end up with a house on them, right. And quite often the large block that's left, you see, if it was a mortgage separation or something like that, the large block is left and ends up getting another house. So this would tend to stop more and more houses coming into the zone. It's not just the little parcels that would tend to, everything about it would tend to help a little. Excuse me, go ahead, Chair.
Mr. Chair, does it take two parcels and make them into one? Doesn't do that.
This bill doesn't do that, but it authorizes, it gives you the tax benefit if you voluntarily.
That's right.
Into one parcel. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You can still build the house.
What?
But it's on one large farm parcel.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, yeah, you're going down the right track, and yes, you could build a dwelling, providing that it's qualified.
Mm-hmm.
You qualified to build a dwelling there. The other issue about large blocks that I have in my testimony to read there, but RS 215.243 establishes the legislative policy on agricultural land use. And in that policy, it provides that it is in the interest and the benefit of Oregonians in general that agriculture be preserved in large blocks. And there's good reason for that. It's more efficient to farm when it's in large blocks, certainly, as well as when it is in large blocks, then it's priced at a price that can be traded back and forth between farmers and ranchers. They cannot afford the price of property when there are all of these non-farm uses that are allowed in the EFU zones right now drive up the price of land to where farmers don't have the ability to incorporate parcels that come up for sale. They're just too high priced. This tends to keep the price down to where farmers and ranchers can afford to buy it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's suppose you have three parcels and you have a house on one of them. The other two are less than the minimum lot size for a house. You can't build on either of them, but you're operating your farm on the whole thing. And you decide to consolidate the two substandard parcels, and by adding them into one, you surpass the minimum lot size. Would you then be able to build a house and receive the tax? Build a second house and receive a tax benefit under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, you're running a hypothetical there, and I think for a minute there's a, if it's other than high-value farmland, and you combine the two, and it is more than 160 acres, then you could qualify to build a farm dwelling.
A second farm dwelling.
On that now 160-acre piece. If one was 159 and one was one, yeah, you combine the two, you could then build a dwelling on it. Where now on the 159 acres, you may qualify to build a dwelling either using the comparability test or the income test, but you wouldn't qualify under the acreage test currently. But by adding that one, you could. So, yeah, in that regard, you probably could. There may be an incentive there. And that we would see as a good thing, actually, because at that point, then you have a farm unit. You no longer have a single one-acre piece sitting off here to the side that is, in fact, has the opportunity, the potential of becoming a non-farm dwelling. Now it's part of a large parcel. Now it truly would be a farm dwelling, and that would be good.
Mr. Chairman, there's another point here. When you have land that is underneath farm control, you just don't have the problems in the community with it. I personally have farmed all my life, and I'm not crying the blues. I think I've been a successful farmer. I've certainly acquired quite a few farms and put them together into a unit. Well, you know, I occasionally have hired help in houses, and occasionally there's a house with just help in it. But you know, those people never cause trouble in the community. They just don't. They're under my control. And we're farm-oriented. And that's very important in the farming community. These little acre spots that somehow got away and have houses in them, that have people in them there that are not farm-oriented in any way, do cause trouble in the community.
Okay. Thank you very much. We've got some other witnesses on this. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Kefouri.
Thank you. Am I correct in thinking that currently the reason that people, if they did own several parcels that were contiguous, the incentive not to combine them is that they can sell each parcel off for a higher price than they could sell them if they were one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kefouri, that's correct.
One other incentive, when you're my age, you're thinking about what's going to happen when you die. And I'm past 80, and I have children. It makes it so that you can divide them up. How do you divide them otherwise?
Representative Bates?
I want to ask a question on this, but I think my understanding is correct, but correct again if I'm wrong. If you've got a parcel of land and you want to split up into different tax lots, it's almost impossible to do that under our present laws, and because we don't want to go that direction as a matter of policy. Okay, if you're in the reverse position where you have a farm with two or three tax lots on it, a lot of people leave it that way for the reason we've already talked about, but those are really not huge financial reasons. The real reason behind all that is if you've got a separate tax lot, you can potentially get an okay for home site on it. And that's what we're really talking about here, I think. You're talking about these being exclusive farm use only, but you've also mentioned some of them have homes on them already. And the real value of a small parcel, 1 to 5 acres, is that you can petition the county, and if you're lucky, get a home site okay for that, which really changes the value of it and changes you from having an agricultural community. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I believe I understand what you're saying. I believe the answer is correct. I would want to make a comment about using the term tax lots, and that's different than parcels. A tax lot is not the same thing. There are lots and there are tax lots, and that's two different things. But I think the illustration you were giving and where you were going is correct.
I believe that's the real concern we have here is when you have farmland split up in small pieces, you can ultimately potentially get home sites on that. And that's the policy we're trying to get away from.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, this would be an incentive. Again, it's a voluntary thing, not forcing anybody to do anything. But if they have one of those parcels or have two of those parcels side by side and voluntarily want to combine them, we just want to give them some incentive to do that. And it may be to their disadvantage to do that. And that's just a choice they have to make at that point.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the time. And we would ask the committee's favorable consideration for House Bill 2876.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here Jerry Kushner. Did I get that right? Good. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Kirshner. I'm a staff attorney at 1000 Friends of Oregon. Many of you are probably familiar with 1000 Friends of Oregon, but I will bore you for one moment to tell you how we do try to develop our policies. We were founded about 26 years ago to monitor the implementation of Senate Bill 100, and over the years found it necessary and productive to create a farmer advisory committee of farmers throughout the state of Oregon to help us develop policy directives, as well as to help us assess bills that affect the farming community that come before the legislature on an annual basis. One of the primary concerns of our Farmer Advisory Committee is the various threats to the land base for the farm industry, and one of them is this parcelization. John Schellenberg spoke somewhat to parcelization that occurred in the past, and I think Yamhill County is a very good example. It had a lot of orchard plats that were platted around shortly after the turn of the century. As our farming practices have sort of grown in size, it's become necessary to have larger parcels. The parcelization in Yamhill County, for example, would not match the economic realities to a certain extent of our farm economy today. 1000 Friends of Oregon is therefore supportive of the policy underlying House Bill 2876 because it would believe that it promotes the state's agricultural land policy, which is to preserve the maximum amount of the limited supply of agricultural land in large blocks to maintain the agricultural economy of the state. You will note in my written testimony that I did state that we had not ourselves analyzed the fiscal impact nor reviewed an analysis of this impact, so my comments are limited to what I believe this public policy promotes for the state. I was pleased to see, though, in that some of the materials to the side that it is indicated that this will have a small fiscal impact, probably in part because it's a voluntary program, also in part because some of these parcels are already receiving special tax assessments under the farm statute. It is, nonetheless, even though the financial incentive may be small, it is a very important step, I believe, to fulfill our state's agricultural policy, in large part because the parcelization of agricultural land increases dramatically the per acre cost for acquisition of new farmland. It makes it more expensive and therefore more difficult for farmers to expand or even begin their farming operations. A good example of that, and this is somewhat dated, it's from 1985 when Umatilla County did some surveys in creating their comprehensive land use plan. But the per acre price for unirrigated land used for grazing and wheat propagation in Umatilla County at that time showed that land prices declined from over $6,000 per acre for a quarter acre parcel to $2,775 per acre for 5 acre parcels and stabilized at $1,200 for parcels that were 92 acres or larger. So I think that really is illustrative of what the land cost effects are when we promote consolidation of small parcels into large parcels. Don Schellenberg also addressed an issue which I think is important, that smaller parcels are less somewhat less useful for agriculture. We know that they certainly are used. There are many farmers, and it's quite common, who farm non-contiguous parcels as small, particularly in the Willamette Valley, as 5 acres. But it is economically more efficient and probably more desirable for farmers to be able to farm on consolidated parcels. I would also note that something that we hear a lot from our farmers on the Farmer Advisory Committee is that when you do have parcelization and you do create the opportunity for building houses, that not only raises the cost of the land for that particular piece, but it sort of adds to the speculation effect in rural areas that, oh, perhaps this land will be rezoned, or there aren't as many, maybe as much agricultural work going on there, and it and it increases the speculation that perhaps they will be able to put a house on their property or perhaps even subdivide in the future. So it's not only what it does in actuality, but what it does in terms of the real estate speculation. In closing, I would note that there's a brief summary of what of our policies about farmland protection and why it's important to the state, both in terms of its livability as well as in terms of what it contributes to our economy. I would encourage this committee to seriously consider this bill. Should there be any necessary amendments to the fiscal impact, consider those as sort of separate from what the important public policy of House Bill 2876 is, and encourage you to pass it out of committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions and appreciate the time to make my comments.
Thank you very much. Questions? Ms. Kushner.
It's interesting, your testimony is that you support the policy objectives, but you haven't taken a position on the bill, particulars of the bill itself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize for perhaps belaboring that distinction. What I intend to say is that we support House Bill 2876 itself. I was concerned and wanted to be honest that we had not addressed ourselves or analyzed the fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? All right. Thank you, Ms. Krishna.
Thank you.
We have from the counties, Bob Cantine and Tom Linares. Are you guys making your first appearance of the session? Wow. It's March. Where have you been?
Me too. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here pinch hitting for Gil Riddell, who left me this little gem and didn't tell me this was Farm Tax Relief Day, and so this is a good bill, should pass. But we do have, I guess, the important distinction for us is to distinguish between a bill which is a trying to fix a tax glitch and one which is a tax relief bill. And I think there you've had both kinds before the committee. Some where there's a problem in the way the tax system works, and some like this one where you're trying to achieve some social purpose with the bill. And that's what this one's about. And let me say a couple of things generally. I'm always nervous when we don't know the fiscal impact, and I'm not sure I've figured out a way yet to get at that fiscal impact for this bill. I'm sure it was maybe overlooked, or just in the testimony wasn't sure what the calculation was, but the comment was made it would be $150 over 10 years, and that sounds pretty small. That's $150, I think, per acre. Mm-hmm. And so then you got to multiply it times the number of acres. And then secondly, it's not clear in this bill, and I'll come back to that in a minute, whether the intent that it be only the A1 of the particular parcels is what the bill reads, or whether it is the parcel after it's consolidated, which would be the whole thing. And that needs, if you're going to work on this bill, that certainly, to me, needs to be clarified a little so that I know what I've got, because otherwise I've got a whole lot of land out there that's going to be exempt under this bill. And I also would mention that if you do work on this and do go forward with it, I certainly hope that you do it in the spirit of sharing the burden of that exemption based on the policy that you've adopted last session. Yeah. Now, when we look at a bill that is just a tax relief or tax break bill, we try to look at the purpose and whether it serves that purpose. Does it get you there? Could you get there if you didn't have the bill? There are other reasons that it ought to occur naturally or anyway. And keep in mind, all of this is assessed property, so that it's got a pretty big tax break already at this point. I think at least the Washington County assessor, I'm not sure whether Tom agrees entirely, estimated over here probably $400 an acre, and on the east side maybe $50 an acre that it's valued at. So we look at the first question is, does this preserve agricultural land? And just take the agriculture part of it and take a look at that first, and I guess I would say I'm not sure. That's really a specific function of what the land is. I guess zone would be the correct word for it, and the type of land that it is. And the bill doesn't necessarily distinguish between the two. And my example, if you're high-value farmland, the notion of a lot of record doesn't apply. So it doesn't allow you to take that small parcel and build on it. If you're in high-value farmland, unless there's some real extenuating circumstances, and I don't know what all those are, but you don't distinguish in this bill between that case and the non-high-value farmland, which a lot of record may come into play, and therefore may be more deserving than the former. I guess, does it encourage consolidation? Yes, but a question I have is, one, it's not permanent, and the person could decide in that 10-year period to sell it, to parcel it again, to parcelize it again, and is there any payback of that tax exemption? If you go back to the specially assessed statute, you know, you have to pay back if you don't do it, and then after 10 years it's over and they could go do it again, where do we get the guarantee over the long term that this is what's going to happen? Could the purpose be achieved without a tax break? That's a tough question there. I'm sure the Farm Bureau would answer, well, the hard evidence is out there that it hasn't happened. So that would be their argument. I think they believe in farming. That's their mission. I think they believe that consolidation would help preserve land in agriculture and in farming. And to me, in some of these cases, like in the high-value farmland, there isn't a big cost to them to just consolidate voluntarily. The cost might be in non-high-value farmland. Maybe there's a question whether that's one where you want to encourage blocking up kinds of things. So those are some of the questions that I have. Let's see, there was couple other comments I wanted to go back to that were made in the testimony. Let me stop there for a minute and let Mr. Lynn Harris comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Lynn Harris. I'm the Columbia County Assessor, and I represent the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I must admit I wasn't even aware of this bill until yesterday afternoon, so I've sort of scrambled trying to come up to speed on it. I did have a couple of questions. In reading the bill, it's not clear to me whether it would be just the land that would be exempt or whether any improvements, including dwellings on the consolidated parcels, would be exempt as well. And I agree with Mr. Cantine. The way I read the bill, the whole consolidated parcel would be exempt. So you're talking about all of the land and all of the improvements to be exempt for 10 years, and I think that the revenue impact just gets significantly different.
Let me just mention, going back to Don Schoenberg's testimony, and I think I agree the bill doesn't reflect this as drafted, but his testimony was that after consolidation, then the smaller of the two parcels will be exempt from ad valorem.
That was his testimony.
That was the testimony, right. So this would be a drafting issue, I think, to get resolved. I think that's the direction we're going here.
Well, Mr. Chair, that would certainly narrow the focus. But again, there's a question of if there is a dwelling on that smaller parcel, is the dwelling exempt as well? And the bill says at least one of the two parcels that are being consolidated is undersized. That doesn't say that both parcels or all three parcels could be undersized. So you could be looking at 3 5-acre pieces in an EFU zone that are consolidated, and they get a 10-year tax break. Well, I'm not sure 15 acres is the large blocking of agricultural land that the policy is meant to encourage. So I don't know if there needs to be a minimum somehow, you know, to prevent that sort of thing. At least one of the parcels being combined has to be greater than, you know, has to meet or exceed the minimum size requirement for that particular EFU zone. And the size requirements do differ around the state. Some counties have much larger minimum acreage requirements than the minimum allowed by law or required by law. So those were my concerns. I'll leave the policy and the land use things because I know just enough about land use to get myself in trouble. But I get after agree with Mr. Kanta. I'm not sure that based on the wording of the bill, and yes, they do have to write a legal description and have it recorded, that to me does not preclude 10 years or 15 or 20 years down the road them coming back and recreating the original smaller parcels as they were before they were consolidated. I don't know that, but I don't see anything that would prevent that.
All right, questions? Good comments. Bob, is there anything else? Okay, very good. I've got a note here from John Phillips and Hacienda Squire that want to testify. Come on up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hacienda Squires, and I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Tom Lanier said he knows just enough about land use to be dangerous. I know nothing about land use, and I don't want to know anything about land use. My cohort in the Special Districts Association, Burton Weiss, deals with all the land use issues, so I just cannot speak to any of the parcels and EFU, and I do understand special assessment, and I do understand tax exemption, and I understand exemption for as an incentive. And I just want to express our association's concern and opposition. I think Mr. Cantine has pretty much summarized some of the issues, but in general, we just don't believe that it is appropriate policy to create an incentive for something through the property tax exemption process.
Thank you for that little cup of cold water.
I know nothing about land use. Shetterly.
John Phillips, what do you have?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips. I'm with the Department of Revenue. My issues are not the same as Hacienda's. We just happen to sign up next to each other. But I did want to point out a couple of things. The department is not for or against this bill. So there are a couple of issues in the bill that would be helpful for clarification to administer it, though. And I think Mr. Lanier has brought up several of those. There was some definitional issues with what a consolidated parcel is. Parcel in Chapter 92 has a specific definition relative to partitioning, and the issue of tax lot was brought up, and that is not a clearly defined issue, and sometimes refers to when an assessor administratively breaks property up into in order to send a tax statement. So it may not have anything to do with ownership. May not have anything to do with other kinds of changes to property. So I'd be happy to work with whoever on this bill to maybe come up with something we can identify what a consolidated parcel is. Secondly, common ownership. That's maybe difficult. Maybe it's not difficult at first to understand what common ownership means, but when you get down to it, you're actually trying to sort that out. It's sometimes it's a person, sometimes it's a person and their spouse, or someone else. Sometimes it's their children are on the ownership deed and those kinds of things. And there is other references in the statute in 308.875 that talk about common ownership as a test. And so maybe if we invoke that same test here, then we have a rule. The department wrote a rule on interpreting that statute. So possibly we could work out something that would be administratively workable for common ownership. Also, a third point would be the May 15th date that's chosen for the application filing. Most applications for exemptions filed the date is April 1st, and that's in 307.162. And if there's a particular reason why May 15th is better, that's fine. But if there isn't, maybe
consistency.
For consistency.
Do you have any better guess than anybody else what the revenue impact of this, or do you have information that could help us on determining what a revenue impact on this might be?
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Okay. It just seems to be so driven by behavior, who would do what in response to this. Yeah.
Right. And the unique characteristics of any particular parcel someone chose to include. My fourth point would be that the period of time where this might occur between April 15th and July 1st, it's mentioned on line 25, is consistent with another kind of, with another statute and exemption statutes, 307-162 also, 1 sub B, and that says for other types of exemptions where things occur between that period of time, the exemption can apply to the following tax year. But it uses a different time frame. Instead of April 15th, it uses, I think, March 1st. So just for consistency, that might be another point unless there's a reason for April 15th. I'm trying to think of maybe income tax due date. I'm not sure why that was chosen. But. And finally, my other point was what Tom mentioned regarding whether improvements are included. It's just not clear. That was all I had.
Any questions for either of these witnesses? Okay, well, I appreciate the testimony on this today. We will look further at this. And unless there's anybody else wishing to testify, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2876, and we are adjourned.